Welcome to part two of our discussion of violent resistance to capitalist aggression. I'm Professor Michael Trussello from Mount Royal University, and I have with me Chris Hedges, the author of Empire of Illusion, which I believe is coming out on paperback in August. Hello, Chris.
I don't know. I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, usually it's a year, so it should be August.
And Derek Jensen, who, like Chris, is the author of many books, including Endgame, and a book forthcoming and perhaps in the new year called Deep Green Resistance, which we may get a chance to talk about. Hello, Derek.
Hey, thank you for continuing this conversation.
It's great to be back. I thought perhaps we would start as a way of creating some continuity with part one of this conversation, which is available at truthdig.org, as well as capitalismisthecrisis.net, which is the homepage for the documentary film that I'm working on, and hopefully some of this will be part of that film. This is a passage from a book called How Nonviolence Protects the State. It's written by Peter Gelderloos, and it's published by South End Press. He writes, and I want to get your reactions to this. He writes, in the Holocaust and less extreme examples from India to Birmingham, nonviolence failed to sufficiently empower its practitioners, whereas the use of a diversity of tactics got results. Put simply, if a movement is not a threat, it cannot change a system based on centralized coercion and violence. And if that movement does not realize and exercise the power that makes it a threat, it cannot destroy such a system. In the world today, governments and corporations hold a near total monopoly on power, a major aspect of which is violence. And he concludes this passage by saying, the elite cannot be persuaded by appeals to their conscience. Individuals who do change their minds and find a better morality will be fired, impeached, replaced, recalled, assassinated. Do we find agreement on that basic premise, Chris?
No. And I think the perfect example is the difference between Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. Although, let's be clear, Malcolm X never employed violence. But he was associated with the Nation of Islam, which did endorse violence. And the real political threat to the power structure was King, as much as I admire Malcolm X. Because King, through the tactics that he used, was able to win over the white liberal class. He alienated the white liberal class, certainly at the end of his life, when he began to speak about economic forms of injustice, the unconscious racism of whites, even sort of well-meaning whites, his opposition to the Vietnam War, without question. But as a political force, he was far more powerful than Malcolm X. In terms of the sort of role of pacifism, I mean, the most powerful period of reformist, progressive, radical movements in this country in those years leading up to World War I, and one thinks, for instance, of the Wobblies, they did use violence, and they used violence frequently. When you look at the Ludlow Massacre in 1914, these were miners in Colorado that rose up against the horrible conditions of the mines owned by the Rockefellers, of course. The Rockefellers finally send in the National Guard, paying the wages of the National Guard members, which result in the deaths of several dozen miners and as well as children who were in these tent encampments. These miners struck back with violence, and they there were repeated periods where radical movements, when pressed, resorted to violence, and this terrified the state. But the problem is that, and I speak as somebody who has spent 20 years covering conflicts, that unless you are in an integrated and highly organized military unit, it is extremely difficult to challenge even a well-trained platoon, especially when they have the capacity to call in air support and heavy artillery and access to armored personnel carriers. In the end, I'm not a pacifist. I was in Sarajevo during the war. I understand that human beings can be pushed to an extent where they are forced to resort to violence. And there are certainly situations where there is no option. But to somehow sort of categorically say that nonviolent resistance doesn't work, I think, for instance, in the case of Martin Luther King, we see the deep fear that King instilled within the white power structure. And let me just conclude before Derek responds to this on the issue of the Holocaust. I not only have been in war zones, but I've been a prisoner. I was taken prisoner by the Iraqi Republican Guard during the Shiite uprising in Basra in the first Gulf War, after the first Gulf War. And when you are surrounded by armed guards and you know that any moment your life can be extinguished, the idea that when you're afraid, you think with another part of your brain. You think about every act that you make, every move that you make is calculated to as much as possible ensure your own survival. And I think unless you've been in that situation, it's very hard to understand how all of us would be docile, that those people who were herded onto carriage cars and railroad cars and taken to the death camps, we would have been no different because they clung to that forlorn possibility of hope. Remember, many of them had children. I was very good friends with a woman named Elena Margolis, who was in the Warsaw Ghetto. She was married to Marek Edelman, the deputy commander of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising and the only leader who survived. And she said, and I think this is very true and very important, you know, to somehow exalt all of the people who led the ghetto uprising were teenagers or in their early 20s at the most. And they didn't have children. They didn't have a responsibility for families. To somehow ask parents to engage in that rebellion. And of course, you know, they knew that there was no hope that they were ever going to create any kind of a liberated zone. They understood in very cold and calculated terms that they were playing with their own annihilation, but they decided that they would die on their own terms because the last transports, the ghetto was being cleaned up with the final transports. But to somehow say that the rise of resistance writers, I'm quoting Alina, was somehow more heroic or more moral than those parents who clung to the hope of their children, clung to the hope that their children might somehow survive and therefore did not join the armed resistance. It is unfair. I think circumstances are different for different people in different situations, especially once you have children under your control. So I'm always a little upset when people use the Holocaust as an example of passivity when they have not been in a climate of where that kind of fear and that kind of control, and which I taste a little bit of, is employed.
Derek?
Well, yeah, as always, I really like what Chris says, and I want to emphasize that for myself, sort of my standard answer to everything is that everything is circumstantial, and I think that there are circumstances where it is appropriate to and most effective to employ nonviolent resistance, and there are circumstances where it is most appropriate to and most effective to employ violent resistance. And we can talk about definitions of violence. And I think Also, it is yeah, that's the main thing I want to say, is that I think that people make rational decisions, and sometimes non-rational decisions, but still a decision that's made anyway. And I don't want to valorize rationality for that matter. But I also want to say about the Holocaust, and I've written this somewhere, that, you know, when all hope is, when all possibility is seemingly extinguished, you know, perhaps the most appropriate and loving thing to do is not to go down, fighting, but instead to, you know, grasp your child's shoulders and try to convey a lifetime's worth of love to the child in, you know, the 3 seconds before you're both shot. I mean, that can be appropriate. And then I kind of want to take this a bit further, because actually I'm writing an essay about this, right? This, you know, but right before I signed on to Skype here, I was writing an essay about this, that I think something that does happen quite often, and I'm in no way saying that Chris was doing this, it's just, it happens that I happen to be working on this, that I think there's a big difference between being an honest-to-goodness prisoner where your options are really limited, except let's also remember there was a successful resistance at Sobibor and at other camps. But at the same, what I really want to get to is there's a difference between being an honest-to-goodness prisoner and putting ourselves into a prison of reducing alternatives for either ideological reasons or reasons of, or other reasons of fear or whatever. And the piece I'm working on right now has to do with how, something I hear quite a bit, something that people use as an excuse for inaction, is they say, well, the climate, global warming is reaching tipping points, and so basically there's nothing we can do. And I cite somebody saying, any human solutions are inadequate, futile, and too late. I wish people would admit this is so rather than scrambling for last-ditch efforts. And that attitude makes me want to scream for a number of reasons, one of which is that I get into this longer discussion of tragedy and how the dominant culture, that somebody, Joseph Meeker, commented that while all cultures have created comedies, only civilization has created this form of tragedy, where you have a tragic hero who has a flaw that brings that protagonist to ruin. And the point really is that the character is unable or unwilling to overcome the flaw. And what tragedies presume inevitably is an inability to choose. And so once again, if you're an honest-to-goodness prisoner, then, you know, honestly, whatever you do, you know, none of us can judge what anybody who was a prisoner in a death camp, or for that matter, a prisoner in a supermax, none of us can really judge what they do, or a prisoner of domestic violence. But what I'm trying to get at is that so many of us presume that there isn't that even though we are quote free, that we still refuse to choose. And I know I'm really getting off topic here, but that's kind of what I do. And so I wanted to say that, but then I want to go back to the beginning and say that for me, it's really all circumstantial. And there are times where it's absolutely appropriate to vote, times where it's absolutely appropriate to write a book, times where it's appropriate to write up, you know, petition the king. And there are times when it's appropriate to pick up a pitchfork, and there's times when it's appropriate to pick up a gun. And the key, the wonderful thing about being a sentient being is that we get to choose. And we also get to choose, we also get to follow moralities. So, yeah, I guess I would sort of generally agree that I think the question becomes, what do the circumstances require?
Perhaps in fairness to Peter Gelderloos, I just wanted to add a clarification of his position. And Chris, maybe you have a difference of opinion based on this clarification. It is Gelderloos' argument that in the case of the civil rights battle, for example, that Martin Luther King, in addition to on occasion being actually advocating violence, would not have been as effective without the existence of Malcolm X and the Black Panthers, for example.
Well, so, King himself wrote that. I mean, he wrote that, that Malcolm X and the Black Panthers and the Nation of Islam, these groups that did endorse violence, made him a more acceptable alternative to the white power structure, and certainly especially the white liberal elite from which he received support, especially financial support. So yes, very much so. But I think that when you look at the internal dynamics of the Panthers, of the Nation of Islam, or of the Weather Underground, you find that violence became such a poison that they consumed the people who employed it. And that is always the danger with violence. Once you start carrying out acts of violence, you must replicate in order to survive the paranoia, the secrecy, the internal purging, and the force that, of course, is used by the state to keep us all in control. And that's what always frightens me about violence. Yet at the same time, I what do you do if you're in the Warsaw Ghetto? What do you do if you know that the final transports are coming? There are moments when violence becomes a last option. I fully recognize that. All I want to caution about is that once that happens, you ingest a poison, and if you're not aware of what that poison is, it can kill you just as surely as the disease. And that's what makes me so skittish and nervous about violence. And yet we should not be herded to slaughter. And let's, in moral terms, what are the people who are the people who run BP or ExxonMobil? They're executioners. They're killers, not only of the human species, but of the very ecosystem that sustains life on the planet. In moral terms, they propagate systems of death, quite literally. And unchecked, they will kill us. They'll kill most of us, along with all the other innocent life forms that had nothing to do with the folly of human existence. So I guess my caveat is that once you touch violence, you inevitably become contaminated. And having seen so much violence in my own lifetime, that's what frightens me. And yet, I won't define myself as a pacifist. I have stood in Gaza and Sarajevo when it was being hit with 2,000 shells a day, and I understand why these people did what they did, and I accept that we may be moving to a time when, because it's clear, as you said from the passage you read at the beginning of this discussion, that these corporate entities are impervious to the will of the citizenry. They have carried out a coup d'etat. They have won. We have lost. We mentioned in the first discussion Bill McKibben, who organized these great protests all around the world, tens of thousands of people, begging corporations and the leaders of the industrialized world in Copenhagen to take seriously this route towards self-annihilation, and they ignored us. And they will ignore us, because serious reform and environmental change means their own extinction. And they will use every weapon they have, and they have physical, everything from the ability to control, the use of physical control, to propaganda, to economic control, in quantities which are, at this point more powerful than the state itself. They will use it. And what do we do? What do we do when, millions of people start dying because, there's nothing to eat? That's really what we're about to face. And yet at the same time, in America, we live in a security state, one which has more forms of internal control than at any other time in American history. You can see glimpses of that control at the G20 in Toronto or where I was in Pittsburgh. It's terrifying. And even small acts of violence, however ineffectual, I think will be seized upon by the corporate state to justify really horrific forms of repression.
I wonder if we could turn just...
Can I respond to that?
Certainly. Go ahead.
Yeah. I really like, as always, what you're saying. I think it's really great. And I want to say a couple things. One of them is that, or a few things, I guess. One of them is that the fact that we live in a security state is a reason to be very careful. And I think at the same time, we need to not overestimate the ability of the security state to keep us in the panopticon. And I think about, I live in Northern California, which means that, the entire county, one county south of here, is based on marijuana. And the economy is. And I also want to emphasize that all the green scare people who've been caught have all been caught because of snitches. They've not been caught because of top of the line police work. And so it's very important for us to be very smart within a panopticon, but at the same time, it's very important, I think, for us not to allow, and I'm not saying we're suggesting this, but it's very important for us to not allow that to paralyze us. And we also have to recognize that no matter what we do, if it's effective in the slightest, we'll be called terrorists anyway. And they'll use any excuse or non-excuse as a reason to ratchet up repression. And, for crying out loud, the San Francisco Chronicle called an insect an eco-terrorist a couple years ago. And so, I think it's really important for us not to allow the enemy to dictate our actions, except insofar as they make it so we're very smart. So that's one thing I wanted to say. Another thing I wanted to say is I just got a quote from Bandana Shiva today. Quote, pesticides are war chemicals that kill every year 220,000 people worldwide, are killed by pesticides worldwide. And I've seen elsewhere that 60,000 people die every day because of the effects of pollution already. And so one of the things I think is also very important is for us to explicitly acknowledge that war has already been declared. And yeah, there was a coup, and that those in power are waging war on the planet. And we need to start thinking about this in terms of war. And another thing I want to respond to, and once again, I want to be clear, I'm not disagreeing with anything you say. I have so much respect for you and for your work, and I'm loving everything you say, is yes, I think we can be contaminated by violence, but I think the truth is that we're also already pretty contaminated by the violence that we see around us, and we're contaminated by not responding, and we're contaminated by being made into slaves and by allowing this to continue. We're contaminated by the situation, which is not to say anything goes, okay, great, you know, as long as I'm already contaminated, I may as well, you know, commit a bunch of atrocities. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that it is inaction in the face of the terrors, of the horrors, inaction in the face of the atrocities is a form of contamination as well. And I think... after we talked last time about how you met Axel Vandenbusche, I was reading more about him. I couldn't remember which participant he was. And as you know, he saw the atrocities, and he said, okay, there's basically, I think, three things I can do. I can kill myself, I can die in battle, or I can stop the atrocities. And I may be wrong on what the three were, but basically that's it. And I think my point is that once he walked into the situation, he had suffered. He could no longer be innocent. And it's like, okay, what do you do then? Which is where we all are now. And the next thing I want to say is, for me, a lot of this boils down to accountability. And when you have, I mean, how do you maintain a social order within a healthy familial or communal structure? And you have some sort of accountability that if somebody does something that's not acceptable, you say, hey, you hold them accountable somehow. And part of the problem is that there are no means to, within this system is set up to privatize profits and externalize costs. And it's set up to protect those in power. And for crying out loud, I don't know if you saw this, but just yesterday there was this multi-billionaire who was systematically raping little girls, having them brought in from all over, including three 14-year-olds were brought in for his birthday. And they've got all this, and he ended up serving nothing. I mean, they can't even get a rich person on something like that. There was this guy, this senator, facetiously said in, I think, 1946 or something, facetiously said, why don't we just go ahead and pass a law making it so that anybody with a net value of more than $250,000 can never be accused of any crime. And, okay, this is all going to come back. It's like, Here's a fantasy I've had for a long time, which I actually think I could stop oil well leaks in a day, which is, you say, okay, you can put in an oil well, and the government says you can put in an oil well, and if this oil well leaks, then you die. The head of the company dies, the accountant who was associated with it dies, the engineer associated with it dies, everybody all down the line dies, and the government regulators who sign on to it, they die. And I would be willing to stake my own life that my analysis is correct. I would be willing to say, you know what, global warming isn't really happening. Okay, kill me. And I would be willing to make that bet with James Inhofe and say, okay, if the average global temperatures are higher in 2013, you know, a weighted average from 2010 to 2013 than they were in, you know, over the past 50 years. If they're actually lower, I'll die. If they're higher, you die, because that would stop the lies. And my point is that, of course, that's not going to happen. I think I told the joke last time about how, what do you get when you cross a long drug habit, a quick temper, and a gun? And the answer is two life terms for murder, earliest release date 2026. What do you get when you cross two nation states, a large corporation, 40 tons of poison, 8,000 dead human beings, and the answer is retirement with full pay and benefits. And that's Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide. And so effectively, the question becomes, and I don't care about assassination or non-assassination. I don't care about, you know, death penalty or not death penalty in this case. However, that's not the point. The point is, how do we hold, well, I was going to say, how do we hold them accountable? But the real point is, how do we stop them? And I want to bring up one more thing before I go on, which has to do with, we haven't really defined what violence is. And what about, one of the things that we talk extensively about in DGR is direct attacks on infrastructure. And those would be, that was actually one of the most effective things that the Allies did in World War II. If we leave off the Russians, obviously the Russians were primarily who beat the Nazis in World War II. But one of the most effective things that the Western Allies did is they destroyed the German rail capacity. And what I really want, I did an interview one time, and I'll shut up in a second. I did an interview one time with a pacifist, a capital P pacifist, who did a terrible, terrible write-up. And he said, I get the feeling that Derek wants all activists to think like assassins. And that's not true. That's absolutely not true. What I want is for many activists to begin thinking like members of a resistance. And what would that mean? A serious resistance. And some of the questions we need to ask are, what do we want to accomplish? What are we really hoping to do? And, okay, I mean, this is what any military person thinks. I mean, I would like for us to start thinking strategically. I would like for us to start thinking tactically. And I would like for us to start immersing ourselves in everything from security culture to recognizing what's at stake, to start thinking very, very seriously about what tactics. One of the metaphors I use all the time is, what would we do if space aliens had come down and space aliens were doing all of this to the planet? I think that it would become very clear. Or what would we do if Iraqis had invaded the United States and, you know, we were told they were this close to invading? You know, what would we do if Iraqis invaded the United States? Like that old stupid movie Red Dawn. You know, how would we organize a resistance, and what would we begin to do? And so what I would really like for us to do is to start thinking like members of a serious resistance.
Well, part of that resistance would have to include the so-called battle over hearts and minds, so that the numbers are there. And I wonder if we might turn to, as Derek said, we haven't really defined violence, but I wonder if we might turn to the definition. And I'd like to refer to the philosopher Slavoj Žižek, who has a book called On Violence. And he talks about subjective violence, acts of crime and terror, civil unrest, international conflict, violence performed by a clearly identifiable agent. He also talks about something he calls objective violence. And objective violence is invisible, since it sustains the very zero-level standard against which we perceive something as subjectively violent. So in other words, I'd like to talk about the cultural inscription of violence in America. How is invisible violence in America framed, whether through popular culture, government propaganda, public relations, mass journalism, even religion? And I know that both of you have written at length on this. But I wonder if you could draw from your extensive analyses to talk about the sort of cultural framing of invisible violence, the kind of systemic violence that allows for the so-called smooth functioning of our economic and political systems, to use Žižek's terms. And Chris, maybe you could begin.
Well, of course, state-approved mechanisms of violence take far more lives than informal acts of violence. In the United States alone, 45,000 people die every year because they're prohibited from receiving proper medical care, courtesy of our for-profit insurance and pharmaceutical industry. In the United States, it is legal for these corporations to hold sick children hostage while parents frantically bankrupt themselves to try and save their sons or daughters. The violence that we have visited on Iraqis, over a million Iraqi dead, the hundreds of innocent civilians who have been killed in Pakistan and Afghanistan because of our drones, the violence that is visited, and although it's carried out by the Israelis, none of this would be possible without our support and approval, the violence that's carried out against the Palestinians, especially in Gaza, the violence that is carried out on the streets of our inner cities. America is, as a culture, one of the most violent cultures in the world. And resisting those. And Derek is right. I think we certainly do have to think in terms of resistance, resisting those forms of violence because they're either romanticized or rendered invisible, is extremely difficult because we live in a culture that is so utterly awash in lies and propaganda. as to create a kind of collective hypnosis or self-delusion, where you have people, through the manipulation of fear and permanent war and self-glorification, in essence clamoring for their own enslavement. And that's extremely difficult to overcome. And it's something that characterizes or distinguishes the modern age from previous ages. The power of mass propaganda, the ability of course, corporate-inspired propaganda to be pumped into our lives through a variety of means, has been an extremely effective form of control. And of course, as Derek points out, essentially the result and the intended result is to create a kind of massive passivity, so that even people who are suffering, even people who are being foreclosed from their homes, even people who have lost jobs that are not coming back, even people who are going bankrupt under their medical bills are disempowered through this propaganda. And I think that any successful resistance has to begin to cope with these mechanisms of propaganda, these kind of celluloid shadows on the walls of Plato's cave, because until people are wrested away from these systems of indoctrination, any kind of resistance is going to be reduced to a very marginal, easily demonized, as Derek said, as terrorists. But I'm fully in agreement that we have to begin to think in terms of ourselves as a resistance movement. I think that that's key, but unfortunately there are very, very few members of the wider public who've, I think, accepted that necessity.
Which is, I think, one reason why you and I write.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I'm done.
A couple things. And once again, everything you're saying is great. When you were talking about the self-enslavement, I thought of that famous quote by Harriet Tubman, which I'm going to butcher, I'm sure, about how, you know, I rescued many slaves. I could have rescued many more if they would have only known they were slaves. And I think about a famous line by a member of the, South African security during the apartheid regime. And there's a great example of how this propaganda slides in and how this, this violence gets, made invisible. Head of South African security. Isn't that a nice term? You know, I think that we all need to be more secure, don't we? I mean, that's like a therapist. He's going to help everybody become secure and happy. But we all know what the head of South African security was doing during the apartheid regime. Head of South African, terrorism, South African torture, South African disappearing, South African murder, mass murder, repression. Repression's probably a good one. Anyway, one of the things he said is that the thing that they were most afraid of from the ANC was not its sabotage or even its violence, but it was the possibility that they would convince the mass of South Africans to not respect law and order as such. And I think one of the most important things that we need to do, it's like, I think I said this last time, about so many indigenous people said to me that the first and most important thing we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds and to see, see the lack of democracy for what it is and to see that we don't live in a democracy, to see that, you know, all the things we've been saying. Okay, and having said this, unless you have another question, I have a question back for Chris, which is, so how do we hold the heads of BP and Monsanto and ExxonMobil and so on, how do we as community members, defining community however we may wish, you know, whether it's our community of resistance that includes being over the internet or whether it's your community in the town where you live, how do we bring or force or cause, use whatever your word you want, accountability to those running the sociopathic corporations? Or more to the point, how do we stop them?
Well, the problem is that we're all a bunch of junkies sitting around talking in very lucid detail about our habit. I'm sitting in a house with central air conditioning. I drive a car that consumes fossil fuels. I am wired for electricity. I go shopping in a supermarket where the tomatoes are trucked all the way to New Jersey from California. And all resistance finally begins with a reorientation of how we relate to the world. And I haven't done that. And I think that a lot of effective resistance is going to be unhooking ourselves from the system that is killing us and killing the planet. And I haven't made that decision yet. And so I'm very wary about everything that I say because I feel that my own lifestyle is complicitous in the murder of the planet. And I think that has to be the first step. But of course, these corporations have created networks and infrastructures that make it extremely difficult. And I think for large numbers of people, impossible to live outside of that system. But I think that effective resistance is going to have to include, as a first step, a severing as much as possible of our own contribution to the perpetuation of the system itself. As you're right, it's going to have to go beyond that. But I think that that's a first step, and it's not a step that I've made. But it's something I think a lot about.
This is so great. I'm so glad you said that, because the whole time I've been agreeing with everything you say, and I'm so happy that finally you said something I don't really agree with. And so I'm just delighted. And the reason I don't really agree is because I think that, yes, I recognize that we need to disentangle ourselves, but I think that there's been this massive propaganda campaign to get us to take responsibility for what's not ours. And I always remember this conversation I had years ago with an American Indian friend. I was saying, oh my gosh, I feel so bad about global warming because I drive a car. And she got very stern and she said, Derek, you didn't create car culture. Don't take responsibility for what's not yours. What you need to do is to bring down car culture. And the reason I'm saying all this is because it gets put on us all the time that what we need to do to save the planet, I wrote the essay about this, forget shorter showers, that we need to, take shorter showers because that'll save water. But the truth is that 90% of the water is used by agriculture and industry, and there's as much water used by municipal golf courses as is used by municipal humans. And so it feels to me like there's some misdirection. I want to be really clear. I actually live pretty cheaply, and I don't waste a lot of water, and I don't, I don't buy stuff for the most part, but that's not really a political act. That's just because I'm kind of a cheapskate. And, I think it's important that we unhook, but I think about this in terms of, that's why, as we know, that's why people in the United States drink coffee instead of tea. It goes all the way back to they were not going to drink the tea from England. I mean, that came through the British monopoly. And so I think that that can be extremely important. And creating these alternatives is exquisitely important. And Maud Gunn, it was so important to have the Gaelic literature revival. So I guess actually, now that I actually say all this, I actually don't disagree with you because all those things are important. But then the key is, I think, like you said at the end, that we have to do a lot more. And then I don't think we should take on responsibility. Once again, I don't think that the crucial thing is how much I do or don't drive. I think the crucial thing is what the actions I take to actually destroy car culture. Because, yes, I'm a junkie, you're a junkie, we're all junkies. What I believe we need to do is to destroy the source of the junk, which in this case is industrialism itself.
I agree with everything you said, but I do think that a personal reorientation, and again, you know, one can go back to the great Christian anarchists like Dorothy Day and Peter Maher and, you know, or the Berrigans. I just had lunch with Daniel Berrigan in New York yesterday, who understood that essentially severing themselves from the society. I mean, Dorothy Day wouldn't pay taxes. She didn't own anything. This isn't the end of resistance. This is the beginning of resistance. That I think that, you know, this particular culture of consumption, this culture built around fossil fuels works because we give these corporations a lot of money. And of course, it isn't a matter of me changing the light bulbs in my cellar to energy efficient bulbs or taking shorter showers. Now, this is the Al Gore, you know, why Al Gore is such a pernicious force within the environmental movement, because he does just what the corporations want, which is, again, to put the burden on us and ignore, as you pointed out, the real engines of global warming, which have nothing to do with me or you. And yet at the same time, I think that that discipline of reorienting how we live our life, and one can go back to read the writings within the Catholic worker movement, that or Thomas Merton or others, that discipline of severing ourselves, in fact, opens up greater capacities of resistance. And so I think that of course it's not enough and it's a first step, but I do think that it is part of the process by which we begin to reorient ourselves to the culture around us, because once we take those steps, we have to begin to ask questions, moral and ethical questions, that those people who blindly sort of follow the herd, are not forced to ask.
Well, thank you for that clarification. That makes a lot of sense. And I think one of the things I was responding to, and I don't know if I mentioned this last time, but over the last 10 years, I've gotten about 1,300, I think, pieces of hate mail. And only two or three of those have been from right-wingers, or those who you would, you know, like pro-corporate people. And all the others have been from various, what I guess I would call lifestyle activists, who hate me, you know, vegetarians who send me hate mail because I eat meat, or anti-car activists who send me hate mail because I drive a car. And there's this sort of personal purity thing that I think that can really make it, that is a real dead end. And so I think that's part of what I was responding to. But then I want to say something else too, which I think is, you know, in Endgame, I bash Buddhism some for some various things, but there's a thing from Buddhism I think is kind of interesting, that is, I've thought about my relationship to automobiles, for example, that living within this culture where I am, I use an automobile, but then here's where the term attachment comes in. That I think one of the things we need to do, and you really helped me to bring this to my consciousness here, with, I think that severing the attachment is really important. That's what's important. And then after that, it's like, you know, go ahead and be a part of the resistance, and it doesn't really matter. You know, you've severed your attachment, I think, is the important thing. That's another way of saying decolonize, I think, in many ways.
I'll give you a quick example. In the first Gulf War, I refused to abide by the press rules. I lived out in the desert. I shaved off all my hair. And I was outside the system, so that eventually when I was arrested by the MPs, and the first thing they did was confiscate my press credentials, my response was, go ahead, take them, I don't use them.
That's great.
I think that once one steps outside the system, one doesn't need the system.
Right.
And I also agree with Derek that a lot of the movements that he cited, and I would even include many among the religious left who embrace pacifism, that when you examine them closely, they're really not about effectiveness. They're about self-exaltation. They're about a kind of self-righteousness and a belief in hierarchies of morality in which, of course, they always occupy the top rung. I think for that reason, although, you know, they probably wouldn't accept it, that once they have built this kind of lifestyle that they have defined as the highest morality, they've run straight into a cul-de-sac because what they sought to achieve, which is an elevation of themselves above others, has been achieved, and therefore they become utterly ineffectual within the wider culture.
I wonder if, with the few minutes that we have left, just before we started recording, you were both talking about working with inmates. Chris, you said you had just come from teaching at a prison. Do either of you have anecdotes about perhaps what you've learned about either thinking or acting outside the system, which you were just talking about, from prisoners? I know, Derek, I think you've helped publish a book by a former student of yours who was in prison, and I guess I'm wondering if you can draw on your experience with teaching and working with prisoners, and if that's helped you in any way conceptualize working outside the system or thinking outside.
I guess since Chris has been courageous enough to go first so many times, maybe I'll go first this time. One of the things that really struck me about many of my students was how much more quickly how there was a lot of shorthand I could use about fairly politically radical ideas, or in fact, they were oftentimes quite a ways ahead of me because they had experienced the state oppression at a much more intimate level. So there were many times where I might say something. And a great example of this is, I remember one time, we just happened to be chatting about the Ruth Benedict good culture, bad culture stuff, how, you know, there are social means by which many cultures have been very peaceful, you know, everybody's fairly happy, women are treated well, children are treated well, and there are other social reinforcement systems, but very shortly, that if a culture reinforces behavior that benefits the group as a whole and disallows behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the group, then that group, that culture is going to be a much happier bunch of people. And I was mentioning this to my students offhand one day, and the students immediately said, yeah, and what happens when one of these good cultures runs into a bad culture that wants to kill them? And just like that, you know, and I said the same thing to college students. And, you know, basically at college, everybody's sort of dutifully writing down this obscure anthropological thing that they're never going to think about again. And I encountered that a lot. And, I mean, the reason is pretty obvious. Once again, because they've experienced state repression on a level that I never have. And, so there was, and I don't want to valorize my students either, that, you know, I had some students who were, frankly, really scary and were people I would not want as neighbors. And there were others that I would want as neighbors, and there were many who were who really understood things politically that I have yet to grasp. That's my version.
Well, I would agree with a lot of that. I mean, the fact is that they come out of, I mean, there is no other class in America that understands the power structure better than African-American inmates. Most of my students are African-American, and all within gang culture. They understand how they have been branded, to essentially spend their lives outside of mainstream society. They're fully aware that most of these people are felons, that any time they apply for a job, once they get out, they're going to have to check that little box on an application form. And as they said to me, that's the first thing an employer looks at. that we have created these internal colonies where there is no possibility for them to find meaningful work within the formal economy. Most of these people deal drugs. They understand violence. They read my book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, and they said I was far too optimistic about human nature. That's the only time that's ever happened to me. They said the natural state of humankind is war. I mean, it all sounded like Hobbes. And when you rip away all the constraints, that's how human beings are. That, of course, I think replicates or their own experience in the hood, as they call it. I'm teaching right now Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, and I think, as Derek mentioned, there's no question that these students get it in a way that students at Princeton, if they got it, they would only get it intellectually, not viscerally. The first question in the class today from an inmate was, if you were a Native American, what is the difference between Adolf Hitler and Christopher Columbus? Well, none. And I think you can get that kind of insight among people who have been crushed by this power structure. That is very hard to get among coddled middle-class kids who have not. And I find it very rewarding and even moving to teach there. I read a few weeks ago Frederick Douglass's Independence Day address, and they started to cheer. I read a passage by Sojourner Truth on Ain't I a Woman, this beautiful passage, and as the inmates filed out to go back to their cells, this huge inmate covered with gang tattoos asked me if he could take a copy back to his cell to have. That these words of the really courageous and moral within our society, these figures like Douglass, Sojourner Truth, Eugene, we were doing Eugene Debs today, the Wobblies, resonate in a way that gives them a kind of visceral power. I mean, I walked out of a class a couple sessions ago and just went into my car in the parking lot and cried because of the kind of hunger and the yearning for this, but kind of the hopelessness that has been visited upon them by the cruelty of our society. I find it, and you know, when you're a prisoner, you look at the world differently. One of the things that they kept asking me when I first went in there was whether I thought there would be a nuclear war. And I said, why? They were very obsessed with this question. And they said, because if there is a nuclear war, the guards will flee and leave us to starve in our cells, which of course is precisely what happened in Katrina. There's a kind of constant understanding or reflection on systems of power that if you don't spend time with those people who suffer most from these systems, I, as, you know, a middle-aged white man who comes from a background of relative privilege, doesn't even have the capacity to see. So I get more out of it than I give.
I'm afraid that I think we're past our 1 hour allotment here, and I promised I would let you go after an hour. I just want to thank you both very sincerely, Derek Jensen and Chris Hedges, for sitting down for this conversation again. Part one of the conversation again is available at truthdig.org. It's also available at capitalismisthecrisis.net. And it's been a real privilege to have you here in this discussion. And I wish you both the best, and I will be following your work.
Well, thank you for doing it, and thank you, Derek.
Yeah, thank you, too. It's been a privilege for me, too.
Okay.
Take care, gentlemen.
Okay.